My name is Wes Granberg Michelson, and be leading the Bible study this week. And this week we'll be dealing, as Larry said, with some biblical perspectives on environmental issues. These sessions will be designed so that hopefully each one of them, in and of themselves, will be useful. But they'll also be a series, so that to the extent that you have the flexibility to come successively, you'll find that one will sort of attempt to build on the one before it as well. So let's pause for a moment of prayer before we begin this morning. Our Lord, we thank you for your creation, for the life which you give, for the grace, for the love which you pour out. Be with us now in this time together. In thy name, amen. A way of introduction, I want to say that this new area for me, one which I have found myself drawn to in the past year or year and a half since I have moved from Washington, D.C., where I was for about 11 years, to Missoula, Montana. It wasn't until I got out of the city that I began thinking seriously about environmental problems, because they're simply part of the fabric of life in many areas of the country, certainly in Montana. When you live there, you cannot help but be impressed by the way in which questions involving land and water and resources are just very much everyday concerns. I should also just mention briefly that I am beginning to do a study on these questions for the Reformed Church in America, which is a denomination. It's the old Dutch Reformed Church, strong particularly in the East and Midwest. It's also appropriate that we should be doing this kind of study, a look at the Bible and a look at nature and environment and how these things fit together here at Holden. Not only because the most obvious form of nature in its beauty is present here, I think we're all aware of that, but also because nature in the sense of it being used and exploited is also very present here. The whole history of the mine and its continuing legacy today, the continuing problems for the immediate environment here that are posed by the mine. We have, I think, all aspects of humanity's relationship to nature represented in a microcosm right here in the village. So it's a good place to be doing this study. Thomas Merton defines compassion in this way. He says, "The whole idea of compassion is based on a keen awareness of the interdependence of all these living beings, which are all part of one another and all involved in one another." That's, as I say, the way the Trappist monk and writer Thomas Merton define compassion. If you look at the word ecology and look at it in terms of its origin, you find that the root of the word comes from a word very often used in the Bible. It's oikos, which means house or household. Ecology, the old G part, meaning the study of something, means the study of the household. Be the way the word ecology would roughly be translated, or the study of how things fit together. Now, if you look at the word economy, which is often put in juxtaposition to ecology, people who are ecologists don't care about economic growth and vice versa, you find the word economy has the same root, oikos. And the word economy actually means the managing of the household. the managing of how these things fit together. One of the dictums of ecology is that you cannot do only one thing. Whenever you do one thing in the world of nature, it has an effect on something else. And when Merton says compassion is a keen recognition of the interdependence of all living things, I think we can extend this notion not only to other people, but to creation, to our environment, to nature. For life, in fact, is dependent upon the very stuff of creation, upon land, water, air, and fire. Without these things, life would be impossible. We depend every day, every minute on these things for our own existence. We don't have to establish a relationship to creation. We have to realize the relationship that already exists, and it is the most intimate kind of interdependence which we discover being there present. So the question we ask is, how do we respond to this reality? How do we respond to the interdependence of our relationship to the created order, and how do we act? In terms of Holden's theme, how do we sing the Lord's song in the midst of the creation and in the present state that we find that creation in today? And to do that, what biblical resources can we find? This is what we're going to be looking at the whole week. How can the Bible help us in this task? Now, we should say right at the outset that this Bible study is one which takes a theme, a concern, and then looks to the Bible for help. The other way of doing Bible study, the way we did it last week, in fact, when we looked at the book of Romans, is to start with a particular point of Scripture and then simply see what it suggests to us in an open way. There are strengths and weaknesses in each approach, and ultimately they become really interdependent because we are always bringing our experience to the Scripture in some way. But let's just note that what we're doing here is that we're beginning with a present human concern, then going to the Bible and seeing what resources can help inform us as we look at this question. All right, let's begin by looking at the state that this created order is in today. And I like to think of land, water, air, and fire. That's the way the medieval mind tended to think about creation. I think it's helpful to us today. We look at land, and we find that 3 million acres of land for farming are being lost each year, according to the recently completed government study, the National Farm Land Study. They're lost to urban sprawl, to suburbs, to shopping malls, to strip mining, and also lost from erosion. A third of all the topsoil in North America has been permanently lost since till agriculture, since agriculture, which drives down into the soil, was introduced, since farming began. A third of the topsoil is lost. It can't be replaced. And the rates of land loss from both erosion and from other means, urban sprawl and so forth, are accelerating, so much so that by the year 2000, this government study suggests that it may be difficult to meet simply the domestic U.S. food needs from land in the U.S. And when any of you who are in agriculture, or any of you know how agricultural exports are the nation's greatest export at this point, you'd realize the drastic effect that we're talking about economically. We look at water. We find that 61 billion gallons of water soak into the ground each day, but 82 billion gallons are withdrawn each day. And we're beginning to see how water shortages are hitting home. Any of you who live in the East Coast or read about New York's difficulties a few months ago realize this. And any of you who live or have relatives who live in the South Central Great Plains under the Ogallala Aquifer know the difficulties in getting water for irrigation. It's said that only 40 years of useful life are remaining in that aquifer. We're draining water out faster than nature is replenishing it. We look at air, and we see currently battles in the Congress to lessen the clean air standards. The push to increase coal burning can threaten, according to some scientists, to raise the Earth's atmospheric temperature in ways that could have disastrous effects. And if we look at fire, by which we really mean energy, we, I think, are all familiar with the accelerating depletion of fossil fuels, the rising prices as a result, the economic consequences that's had through the whole society, and the dangers to the fabric of creation that are posed by some of the alternative means suggested, such as nuclear power, and the search for other sources of energy. In summary, I think what we say with a very quick look is that creation is, in fact, in a serious state of jeopardy. What sustains our life and what we often take for granted is being threatened, is even deteriorating. So we would look to the Bible, we would hope, and find some help. But here we immediately encounter a problem posed to us by secular environmentalists, not all, but some. Some environmentalists who say, listen, the Bible is not the solution. They say this to Christians. The Bible is the problem. The Bible is what has gotten us into this mess. After all, doesn't the Bible say, subdue the earth? And hasn't that been used as the rationale for all the exploitation and plunder and damage to the environment in modern times? Hasn't Christianity justified and rationalized the ravaging of resources in the name of God, in the name of people being good Christians, in the name of people subduing the earth? And isn't Christianity hopelessly anthropocentric? Doesn't it have humankind so much at the center of its value system that no value is given to other life? And doesn't it say in the Bible that humanity's purpose is to dominate over nature? And historically, hasn't a kind of war against nature mentality been produced by the church? So immediately when we ask this question, if we're in dialogue with environmentalists who are secular, we find that we have somewhat of a problem on our hands. I want to read a little bit from a famous article written by Lynn White in 1967, appearing in Science magazine. Lynn White, one who really gave popularity within the environmental community to the argument I've just been saying. He says this, "By gradual stages, a loving and all-powerful God had created light and darkness, the heavenly bodies, the earth and all its plants, animals, birds, and fishes. Finally, God created Adam, and as an afterthought, Eve, to keep man from being lonely. Man named all the animals, thus establishing his dominance over them. God planned all of this explicitly for man's benefit and rule. No item in the physical creation had any purpose save to serve man's purposes. And although man's body is made of clay, he is not simply part of nature, he is made in God's image. Especially in its Western form, Christianity is the most anthropocentric religion the world has ever seen. Christianity, in absolute contrast to ancient paganism and Asia's religions, not only established a dualism of man and nature, but also insisted that it is God's will that man exploit nature for his proper ends. Christianity made it possible to exploit nature in a mood of indifference to the feelings of natural objects." And White concludes, "Christianity bears a huge burden of guilt for the shape in which we find our environment today." Well, that might be difficult enough, but then we have the election of Ronald Reagan, the appointment of James Watt to Secretary of Interior. And we find that James Watt is a confessing evangelical Christian and one who has spoken theologically about his views on the environment and spoken in ways which make accusations like Lynn White's prophetically clear and true. And he speaks in ways that make what Lynn White say seem as simply apparent. Secretary Watt told the Wall Street Journal, quote, "My responsibility is to follow the scriptures which call upon us to occupy the land until Jesus returns." When he was testifying before the House Interior Committee, he said, "I do not know how many future generations we can count on before the Lord returns." This was in response to a question about caring for the stewardship of future generations. The implication of this would be we can exploit the resources of creation now without a concern for how future generations will cope with those results. So this theological perspective, which has been around in our country a long time, Roger Field in his sessions has talked some about this and probably will be more, has certainly been a part of Western history, at least since the Reformation and especially since the Industrial Revolution. But this perspective, the perspective of exploit nature for all we can get out of it, because that's what we're supposed to do, that's what God tells us to do, God gives us this for our own benefit, for the benefit of humanity, that's now given sanction and popularity by the caretaker, by the nation's caretaker of its lands and resources. The person put in charge of these resources is now preaching in that same vein. We have other problems as well we encounter when we say, how can the Bible help us deal with the crisis that is posed to the creation today? How can it help us deal with environmental questions? We find that in recent history, at least in our country, there's been a noticeable lack of both theological concern or Christian engagement in environmental issues. And I think that there are a few reasons for this. I'll just touch on them briefly. Firstly, on the fundamentalist side, what today we call evangelicalism, the battle lines were drawn between Darwin and the Bible. And the effect of that battle, those who were not fundamentalists tended to conclude that Darwin was inerrant. But a deeper effect was that a split between the natural scientists and Bible-believing Christians set into our culture in a deep way. It was not simply that the fundamentalists denied evolution, but more than this, the effect of what their attack against Darwin was to sever any connection between humanity and the rest of creation. You see, it reinforced humanity being separate and apart from the rest of creation. And we're living with this legacy still today, especially in the evangelical churches, but in a broader sense as well. Secondly, when you look at the history of the church's social and political concern, you see this evident around issues in the past, such as the war in Vietnam, or poverty, or the nuclear arms race today. But you see very little involvement of the church in environmental questions. When you look at mainstream Protestant thinking, we find in the past 30 years, especially since World War II, the dominant influence of theologians like Karl Barth, who put forth what is called a neo-orthodox theology. Part of this theological stance is a rejection of what is called natural theology, meaning the old idea in the church that if you simply go to the world, you can kind of build building blocks which will lead you to a knowledge of God which will be the same as that in fact is given in the scriptures. That kind of theology was rejected. A focus was instead put on faith experienced within ourselves at points of crisis. And Barth himself wrote, "We are asserting that we have no certain information concerning the unity of our life with the life outside of us." One of Bart's compatriots, Emil Brunner, put it more directly. He said, quote, "Nature is nothing more than the scenery for human history." Right? So you have, in this strain of theological thought, a statement that says all that nature is the scenery. Where the real stuff, the real history of God's relationship to the people takes place. It's just a stage. It's nothing, you know, it's just sort of the stage where the mighty acts of God occur. In this rejection of natural theology, there also seems to be little basis for constructing or reconstructing a theology of nature. And for those of you who want to pursue these things theologically, there's a big difference between what you would call a natural theology on the one hand, and on the other hand, having some basis for constructing a theology of the natural world. All right? Because if you emphasize God's transcendence over against the world and talk about our encounter with God at the point of crisis in faith, we see, and if this is the sole way in which we tend to think about our Christian experience, we simply don't have too much equipment for dealing with a theological approach to nature itself. Now, another problem, and this is primarily what we're trying to do in this first session, we're trying to list the hurdles that we have to get over before we get to how we can look at the Bible in ways that will really inform us and will really help us. Until we get over these hurdles, we're not going to be able to, I think, really get out of the Bible what the richness that is there for us. This next problem is simply the way our modern mind has developed, the way in which all of us are accustomed to thinking, and the kind of effect that has had on us. And let me try to sketch this very, very briefly. Any historian would probably get cardiac arrest by my quick excursion through three or four generations of history of thought, but let me try it anyway. The way the modern mind thinks is to detach the person from the world. When you think about this for a while, we think of the world as something outside of ourselves which we can objectively understand and control. We're detached from it. This is, of course, the basis of the scientific method that Francis Bacon laid down. Descartes used mathematics to explain how nature functioned. You know, he explained how this all happened in mathematical laws. Newton took the laws of motion, the laws of just how things move, explained them mathematically. So a kind of mechanical model of the world has become easy for us to adopt. We think of the world as if the world was sort of a machine. The world as if it consists of a bunch of particles arranged in various ways, functioning according to various laws. We see them, we observe them, we interact them, and we can try to control them. Now, even modern physics today totally repudiates that kind of view, but yet I think it's the way most of us think, because it's the way the modern era has taught us to think. You look at people like John Locke, who argue that natural reason and self-interest would uphold society, and that nature, that the stuff of nature, is only of value if it's converted into something useful and made into wealth. And if a tree's just sitting there, it doesn't have value. It has value only when it's cut down and made into lumber and made into something that's useful to use. The same kinds of ideas were adopted by Adam Smith in economics. And all this had the effect of raising the issue, well, then where is God? Where is God in all this? In reaction to these strains, some people said, well, God is located in our hopes, our dreams, our destiny. But people like Feuerbach called those things mere projections. Marx then followed and said, it's humanity that makes history. God doesn't make history, humanity. We have to make history. Freud said that God wasn't in our feelings. We couldn't locate God there. And Darwin freed God from creation itself. Not that Darwin intended that, but the way people took his thought. All this meant that there has been a decisive change in how the modern mind, how we today understand ourselves in the world. I want to read a quote from an author named Owen Barfield, who talks about the difference in this case in the way the medieval mind looked at the world and our mind today. Listen to this. It is clear that the medieval man did not feel himself isolated by his skin from the world outside him to quite the same extent that we do. He was integrated or mortised into it, each different part of him being united to a different part of it by some invisible thread. In his relationship to his environment, the man of the Middle Ages was rather less like an island, rather more like an embryo than we are. So you see, what's happened is that there's been a big change in simply the way we think. People haven't always thought the way we think. The medieval mind didn't think that way, and most certainly the biblical mind didn't approach things the way we do today. In the medieval mind, the appearance of something in the world was what you could call a representation of a reality behind it, in a reality to which the person was connected, so that when you perceived something, you also participated in it. Next time you see a rainbow, think about it and ask yourself whether the rainbow exists out there or exists in your mind and in your eyes. And you begin to see a difference in understanding. You see, I mean, you can't go out there and you can't find the end of a rainbow. You can't put your hand around a rainbow. A rainbow, yes, it exists out there, but it also exists in the way we see it. A rainbow doesn't exist except for the way we participate in seeing it. Okay? It's more in that vein that the medieval mind approached the world. The modern mind, since the scientific revolution, has changed this. The self is separate from the world. The world is seen as just the sum total of a bunch of particles. It's objectified. It's externalized. What happens then to the spiritual? Well, it gets to be internalized. The spiritual is what happens inside of me. Spiritual things happen in another whole realm. See, they can't be explained scientifically. Scientifically, we've explained away any need for God to exist in the world. So thus, the spiritual becomes internal, the objective becomes external, out there. And this great division sets in between the spiritual and between the material. One way of putting it is to say, since the modern view of the world emptied God from the world in any objective sense. I mean, the modern view, all these people that I was naming, they explained God's existence away in any objective sense and said that matter, the stuff, this, you know, the stuff we encounter, it's only matter. It's only particles arranged together. The Christian response has often been, well, if matter is only matter, well, then it doesn't really matter. See? I mean, it doesn't really count if that's all that it is. The things that count, the spiritual things, are apart from the world, from the things we touch and interact with. You can't see them. They're sort of inside of us and between us and God. So we then take this outlook and we read it back into the Bible. You see, we take these lenses, these glasses that have been put on us by thinking in the West for the last 200, 300, 400 years, and we then read the Bible with this sort of perspective in mind. And I think in so doing, we're unable to grasp the full message of what the Bible has to say. And as long as we have these kind of lenses on, we buy the notion that the Bible has, or I mean, we can buy the notion that the Bible has very little to say in terms of concern for the environment. In another way, we simply aren't given much of a tune to sing the Lord's song. Now, if we tried to go to the Word of God as a starting point with this concern in mind, If we tried to say, okay, we have to listen to the things the environmentalists are saying, take those charges seriously, see whether they're true or not. I mean, has, in fact, this environmental predicament been the result of the church? We have to answer that question. We have to think in ways that are free from the way modern thought has programmed us to come at things. We have to free ourselves up and question some of the things we've maybe never have really looked at deeply before. We have to get over this sort of division between material and spiritual. We have to get over some of the defensiveness that we may have from particular evangelical backgrounds about the whole world of natural science. The natural science sort of the world that undermines what the Bible has said to be true. We have to look at that whole controversy and somehow get beyond it. And then I think what we must first declare is that there is no cleavage in the biblical point of view. There is no dividing line between humanity and nature in some distinct sort of way that just totally sets us apart. All right? And in the same token, I want you to listen to this, there is not the kind of metaphysical barrier between God and the creation. We think of humanity as separate and totally apart from the world of nature. The rest of, you know, we think of ourselves as so separate from it, and we think of God as being totally apart from the creation. Now, there's biblical truth. There is a thread of biblical truth in each of those declarations. But to the extent which they've been taken, they simply no longer resonate with the whole biblical message. In fact, that kind of thinking, the way it is in our thoughts today, is really the product of the Enlightenment. It's the product of modern thought. It's not the product of the Bible. Because if you go back to the Bible, go back to the Old Testament, and go back to Hebrew, you'll find that there isn't even a word in Hebrew for what we would call the world of nature. The Hebrew word doesn't even exist. You say, when we say nature, we think we mean the trees and the mountains and the rivers and the air and, that's nature. And then we say humanity, mankind, whatever words we use, and that means sort of us. In the Hebrew, to think of nature as an autonomous realm, not in relationship to God and to humanity, it's inconceivable. There's no word for it. In Hebrew, you say creation, but by that word you mean humanity, and you mean God as the creator of this creation. See, if you're a writer of the Old Testament, you can't use a word which means nature apart from humanity, because such a word doesn't exist, because such a thought didn't exist. There was in the writers of the Old Testament, they just assumed the kind of interrelationship which in fact we know does exist between us and nature. It's impossible for any one of us to live apart from land, air, water, and fire. We would die. That the sort of relationship is clear. The biblical writing reflects this. One theologian, Joseph Sittler, puts it this way: nature comes from God, cannot be apart from God, and is capable of bearing the glory of God. Now, that is different, of course, than saying nature is God.
Would you read that again, please?
Nature comes from God, cannot be apart from God, and is capable of bearing God, the glory of God. All right? As I say, that's different than saying nature is God. That's quite a different statement. But this statement correctly implies the kind of interrelationship that exists between what we call nature, or what would be better to call creation, in God. And it's reflected throughout the scriptures when you think about it. The Psalms that we, the Psalm 65, which we had at Eucharist last night, many of the hymns that we sang at the Eucharist service yesterday, and that in fact we've been singing the past 2 or 3 days, Psalms like Psalm 19, verse 1, the heavens are telling the glory of God, and the firmament proclaims his handiwork. At breakfast this morning, we read from Psalm 145, which is similar to Psalm 104. Part of that psalm reads, all of them look expectantly to thee to give them their food at the proper season. What thou givest them, they gather up. When thou openest thy hand, they eat their full. Then thou hidest thy face, and they are restless and troubled. When thou takest away their breath, they fall, and they return to the dust from which they came. But when thou breathest into them, they recover. Thou givest new life to the earth. May the glory of the Lord stand forever. May he rejoice in his work. The kind of interdependence, the intimate kind of relationship that exists between God and God's creation, reflected clearly and strongly. Many other psalms, as well as passages in the Old Testament, some of which we'll be looking at in the next 4 days. Again, a quote from Sittler from his book Nature and Grace, which we have in the bookstore and which I would recommend as one of the books you may want to look at this week. He says, it is a fallacy to suppose that because we know about and think about atoms, genes, astrophysical space, an organization, we are thereby thinking about the creation. Creation is a religious and philosophical term. It is not a term whose proper reference is simply the fact of or possible structure and process of the world. The term creation contains and requires a God postulation. Until we get this through our heads and permit nature to retain its intransigent reality, we shall neither theologize soberly nor be theologically guided to act constructively. There's a lot of fancy theological words for simply saying the same thing. We go back to the statement we said at the outset, Merton's definition of compassion, and we could maybe change it just a bit and say, compassion is a keen awareness of the interdependence of all things in creation, which are all part of one another and all involved in one another. Well, these are, I think, a few of the footholds or starting points we can take to look at the Bible and help it speak to us and make sense to us, help us hear its message more fully as we encounter the environmental realities of the day. Tomorrow, we'll be looking specifically at Genesis 1 and 2. And of those of you who want to come and follow along, I might suggest you go back and read the first 2 chapters of Genesis before tomorrow. But for today, we'll stop now and open it up to you to discussion.
I'm concerned about what White said, but that perhaps for tomorrow. Because if you read the first chapter of Genesis and go on into the second chapter to the third verse and stop there, you know that the woman wasn't created as an afterthought. Now, if you go from there on and decide that you want the woman to be an afterthought, you can do that in the second chapter of Genesis. The other thing is that it says very clearly in Genesis that the earth was to be replenished, not exploited. The Garden of Eden and everything else that was created was to be replenished, which is quite a different thing from exploitation. And so that refutes almost everything that White said.
Well, I'm not going to make White's argument for him. And these are precisely some of the things we're going to be looking at tomorrow. Genesis 1:26 through 1:28, when it speaks of the command to subdue the earth, and the sense of that term in Hebrew is a very strong sense. You can't say, well, it's just a mistranslation. That one phrase has been taken in recent times, but recent I mean the last 200-300 years, to mean all these vast resources of nature are there for us to exploit, to harness, to rule over, to subdue. And I think that White has a good historical argument. I don't think he has a good biblical argument, but I think he does have a decent historical argument. Yes, please.
It seems like not to argue for him, but he's looking at something that is actually happening. Mm-hmm. He's saying, okay, this is what's happening. We make bottles that you can't reuse, or we do this that you can't do. We're running out of these resources. Why? You know, I would assume that paper was written to try to come to an understanding as to why that's being done. And one of the explanations that the way that he zeroed down was saying, okay, here are one of the influences of Western mm-hmm. thought has been this. But we can see it in our art also. Eastern art has a little person with a big valley and a river, and it mm-hmm. kind of shows that person as being mm-hmm. at the whim of nature, where we seem to be, our thought and our projection and our art, and not just religion or whatever it is that we control nature. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Other questions, because we're, you know, this is our beginning time, so any questions or comments or corrections, you know, perhaps some of you have different ideas, let's just throw them out. Yeah?
The idea on land as one of these four, mm-hmm. the American Indian, for instance, regarded the land as nobody's property, mm-hmm. really. It's there for everybody to use. Now here comes the European and he takes over and he squats on it, and this is mine. Right. Do you think that perhaps some of that notion comes out of the land promises of the Hebrew? I'm going to give you a land, flowing with milk and honey.
Right. That's Wednesday. that's a question right on target, and I think we need to look at that question. We need to say how our relationship to the land, and what is this. Is this tied in? That's what Watt says. That's exactly what he's quoting. And when he told the Wall Street Journal, I'm going to occupy the land until Jesus comes. Now, he's got the Old Testament and the New Testament fit in real quick in one phrase, but the occupy the land is from the Old Testament, and until Jesus comes, what he's implying is that the word that God gave to the children of Israel when they looked out on the land of Canaan and said, go occupy it, go take control of it, and we're just to keep doing this until the Lord returns. It raises a lot of questions about looking at these relationships in the Old Testament, looking at the idea of land, and like as you suggest, the way we understand it today is in contrast to maybe other understandings. But what I think to really say, does the Old Testament have something to say to us here? What do we find there?
Very urgent question.
In this big picture of history, that are we running on a self-destruct kind of like lemmings right now? It's nowhere in history did we ever get to this point where we are running on a self-destruct, such as you mentioned, with the aquifer and everything else. I either don't have any answers, but sometimes you sit back and wonder that why is God letting us run on this course that's in the last, since 1950, even if you don't even go back any farther than that. But I don't understand it. Uh-huh. And uh-huh. more of the questions is that why are we running a course of self-destruct? Because that balance of water, balance of everything.
Right.
Why are we responding to that? They don't understand it, and that we have never done this. Actually, we have done this in the past. My background is partly in physical anthropology, so there have been neural institutes back as far as we can go of humans overexploiting, kind of long term, I guess, anyway, overusing their resources to the point where they literally were driven out of the area. So it's not, this is not a unique thing.
Yeah, I understand that in history, but I mean, this is a total Earth self-destruction.
But I don't see the difference between that and a micro.
Yeah.
You know,
I mean, well, it's quite.
The only difference is
you
now we no longer have any place to move to.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. Uh-huh. Is that before history, you can see where these civilizations disappeared because they used it up. But here we have a complete Earth.
Okay, one other thing to remember is that other animals do it too, like prey dogs. Mm-hmm. Prey dogs eventually pollute the environment to the point where they have to leave the building. And ultimately, that ends up being good for the overall environment in which they live. Fertilized, cultivated, turned over the soil to extend many thousands of tons in their area. And there may be other purposes in this whole thing that we don't perceive. You see, but you reckon the one unique thing is we have no place else to go. But I think the use of these resources and the turnover, and I'm a kind of an environmental person too. I mean, I'm Jared Clover and I'm an Titan. But what I'm saying is, there is some sort of purpose there, I believe, in this whole problem we are not yet perceiving.
This is raising the questions about direction of history and God's role, God's sovereignty, our responsibility, etc. in this, which we'll try to get to during the week as well.
Larry.
On that remark, that bit of humor from Howard Odom, the ecologist. He said one time that humanity's whole purpose on Earth was to transform the hydrocarbons from a solid state, or liquid state, such as coal and petroleum, into a gaseous state, because it's pollution. And when that's finished, then we'll be finished, and then we'll serve our purpose.
Well, okay, take it one more step. I don't know who's watched Cosmos or not, but Carl Sagan. And how much you delayed on that, but looking at the universe and trying to find another Earth-type population in his Carl Sagan's theology, that the idea that when they reach this ultimate technology, they destroy themselves. And that's why we're not finding other planets out there that are alive. Mm-hmm. That kind of thought is kind of quite the case, that we reach this ultimate end.
Well, our transportation said that, as far as you could judge, human beings always had to enslave something in order to free something else. There's always been a master-slave relationship. So transportation said it would be a great step forward if we quit enslaving human beings, but we'll have to enslave something. So his proposal was, let's enslave nature. In order to see if it's benefit for humanity. I don't know what Scotland wants to do in that, but there is that contention that a master-slave relationship is built into the human, a kind of human drive, and that we continue that now by regarding nature. I suppose there's a reputation of that. There are lots of societies that have treated nature that way. Yeah. So you had to think about generalizing from Bacon, but you certainly see some of the origins of our modern attitudes toward nature, particularly regarding it, as our phrase is natural resources. And what are resources? To look at all that out there and call it natural resources is indicative of a relationship. Those are resources for us.
And
to you.
Right.
And then you have to play the
yeah, and following from Bacon to the thought of a person like Locke, who really declared that these resources of nature had no value unless they were used. That's right. It's the transformation of the back process.
I think that master slave relationship, when directed to Genesis 1:28, and my misinterpretation of that. Mm-hmm. Also, I think it would be nice to touch this week on the fellow pointed out that it wasn't unique to America, that other cultures had developed mm-hmm. this kind of thinking. But in America, the big is better, and the vast expanses that we have that are fingertips, I guess. The art of the frontier a little bit, I think there might be heel step and pushing left, and there's just this limitless, you know, distance control.
Over here, the word. Paul?
I'm not telling about lots at all. But what he was trying to do is not say that it was a course of all values, but it was a sort of frame of values. But I'm not sure if one can say that a lot. In fact, the fact that it was it hadn't gotten to the point where anybody would say the course of all values.
Yeah, I think that's probably accurate. I think that's probably accurate, Paul. And it's probably, it's like, in fairness to people at that time, when, you know, when Locke is living in a situation where there's great accumulation of capital and held by very few, and when he's looking at all these people who have very little, and it makes sense in that frame to say, well, you know, each person has to become productive and has to take these resources and to make it into productivity. That's going to, you know, that's going to then face the good of the whole. In his historical context, that made a sense that today it doesn't. And it may be more accurate to say, well, it's not just Locke's thought, but it's the way in which we have inherited and appropriated the legacy of that thought. It's probably more of a philosophical mind. That would probably be a little more accurate.
The other thing is that people who want to use the environment want to exploit it. But I think it takes some offense at being characterized and not realizing the interdependence of the individual. Of course they realize the interdependence. They're afraid of the drop in the water table. Anybody else realize they're dependent on the water. The ultimate division between our environmentalists and the others is over what the purpose of nature is or what it should be, not over. And so I think the theological discussion is on independence and the things would be perfectly acceptable and they say, well, of course. But it's come together something like the whale guard.
I think, however, that we've become accustomed to acting towards the environment as if we, without recognizing our full dependence upon it and the dependence of others and the future generations, we have at least become accustomed to acting in ways which deny that.
I think I actually hear that in the conversation. I think I hear when people say environment, they mean what we usually mean when we say nature, namely outside of ourselves. We do not think ourselves as part of the environment. And if I could push you a little bit more, the term creation is also not a synonym for nature. Creation, biblically, is nature and society together. Are not inseparable from one another.
Right.
So I think even our conversation still reflects the division of humanity as part of nature from environment and from creation. Our think with are still functioning.
That's right.
Even when we talk about interdependence.
Right.
And so we still see ourselves over against it. We say, yes, we are clearly interdependent, but our assumption is that we're outside of it far enough that we can be the manipulators of it and affect it in ways that redound to our purpose without somehow ourselves understanding the complexities because we are interdependent.
I want to ask you about whether I understand you right in creation. That what I was suggesting is that if we try to come up with a better word, it may mean that creation may be a better word as long as we understand by that not nature, but rather all that the creation of all that is, including ourselves and our relationships. Now, do you think that that's so, or do you think that that word is still?
I would be fun to try this week to see what some dimensions of that are. Mm-hmm. I mean, we may get back to stuff that Corey calls the whole public household, which is organic, inorganic, human, animal, other animals, et cetera, et cetera.
One of my problems.
We tend to make it a synonym and then put it outside of it. So you're talking about creation as we see it here.
Yeah.
So I think in Hebrew, creation as we see it here would include the building.
Yes. Yes, it would. Yeah. This is one of the problems, and I just say, talking about, I don't know what to even title the series, because there's any of the terms that you pick on, you may choose, have the kind of limitation that Larry is just suggesting. And that's just not a semantical difficulty. It indicates what I was trying to say, difficulties with the way in which we naturally think and approach these questions and the need to come at them in fresh ways. We have time for one more, I think. Well, two more, there and there, because I saw two hands I don't want to shoot.
I think one thing too we have to keep in mind is that the creation story was a picture of the world in balance, where everything was created good. We have to take a look at that and say, okay, today there's a lot of imbalance in the world. And man's duty was to subdue the earth, was to subdue the imbalances and bring that back into harmonious existence again. Mm-hmm. And I think that focus could be very meaningful if you take a look and say, a lot of today's creation is not the same as it was 4,000 years ago or whatever. Today we've got a lot more concrete and metal and everything else in our environment that is changing. Mm-hmm. The world and the creation that we are living in today. And how do we correct the imbalances, the food shortages, situations we do in the inner city compared to what we have out here in Holden, and try to put all of that into a focus of how does man subdue the earth to create a balanced environment?
Because another thing, I'm glad you brought that up, because it's another way of thinking about does subdue the earth mean bring it into its proper balance. This is what you're suggesting. Okay. And then you had another shot.
Well, this probably isn't too relevant except for my curiosity. Oikos, the etymology of the word, and perhaps that shouldn't be forced too hard, but is oikos the house or the household? Does that make any difference?
Well, I have to appeal to Greek scholars to help me here. I understand the word to imply not, it would mean house, but when you say that, you don't mean just the physical structure, you mean household is probably a little closer way to capture what that word means. Larry, can you help me out there?
I think that's right. Oikos is the noun for house. Mm-hmm. But,
that's kind of important, though, if it's just the house, if it's just the outer shell.
Well, yes, but ecumenical. I mean, if you use it as the root, if you use it as the root for other things, ecumenical means fostering the unity of all members of the household. Economics means providing for the material well-being and for the household and managing as well. Ecology, understanding the conditions, the fragile conditions of life upon which the household depends. So I think it is. I think Wes is right. You see it as a root for these other things, and it's more than the shell. It's the household, including material, non-material, human, non-human elements.
The way in which we get the word stewardship comes. It traced back to the same source as well. Also, when you read in the New Testament about the plan of God's salvation, the plan, I mean, this also goes back to the same to the same root. So it's very interesting to see these kinds of interconnections. I think they help us in how we come at the fresh understanding of the biblical word. Well, okay. I hope this has raised more questions than answered. That was the intention today. We'll
turn tomorrow specifically to Genesis 1 and 2 and to the issue of subduing the earth and to how we understand or can look at the creation stories, how this part of the scripture may help us on these questions. So thank you very much.